Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How important is cooking, and what are the health effects of outsourcing this most basic task to restaurants and the processed food industry? Many people know Berkeley journalism professor Michael Pollan as a champion of healthful, sustainably produced ingredients. In his new book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation, Pollan explores the ways that these raw building blocks of recipes are changed and improved through processes like roasting, fermenting, braising, and baking. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Good to be here.
So you tell us that until recently, cooking your food was something you had invested not a great deal of time or energy in, even though you'd been growing your own food since you were eight.
Yeah, I've always had a garden. But I didn't grow enough to feed my family. It was just kind of a little sideline thing. But I cooked, and just not with a lot of thought or care. And I did it as fast as I possibly could. I was very impatient in the kitchen. I had trouble kind of being there and doing things like, you know, chopping onions without resenting it.
Yeah, I was amazed to read that, like, the average American family now spends a total of less than half an hour throughout the entire day preparing food.
Yeah, 27 minutes cooking, and that's defined loosely, by the way, and 4 minutes cleaning up, which tells you that cooking is defined loosely because, you know, what can you really do in 4 minutes? You can crumple a pizza box. Mm-hmm. And scrape a couple plates, probably. So we're cooking less and less. It's fallen by about half since the mid-60s. But the weird thing is, well, there's a couple weird things about it. One is that we're spending, you know, much more time watching other people cook on television. So, you know, at the same time we're cooking less, we're watching it more and obsessing about it but not doing it.
It's funny because ostensibly all those TV cooking shows are supposed to engage us in cooking, but I suppose they set the bar really high.
Well, I think that's exactly right. I think they make, I'm talking about the primetime shows, not the ones during the day, which are a little bit more practical. But at night, cooking is treated as a competitive sport. And it looks really daunting. I mean, there are knives flying and fountains of flame and a clock ticking down the minutes like the end of a basketball game. You know, it looks like something best left to professionals. And so I actually think that this obsession with cooking on television and also the celebrity chef culture is intimidating people and probably leading to less cooking rather than more, which is paradoxical anyway.
Which is funny because, I mean, I've talked to a number of chefs on this show, and they'll all admit that they don't cook for their families or for themselves at home the way they cook in a restaurant. That's meant to be a special occasion.
Well, that's right. And I think that's the bar we're all trying to hit, because that's what we read about and that's what we see in restaurants. And many of us who can't cook restaurant-quality food will tell you, oh, I can't cook very well. Well, you can cook perfectly well, and everyday home cooking is a completely different kettle of fish. And that's why, you know, I think people should relax about it. I was talking to a friend in New York who said, yeah, no one has dinner parties anymore. It used to be when you went over to so-and-so's house, you got the chili, and you went over to this house, you got the lasagna, and you went over to that house, and you got a, you know, grilled steak. But now no one feels that's good enough. So instead, they're not cooking at all. Hmm. And I think that intimidation factor is part of the problem, along with the time crunch, of course.
Yeah, and that's interesting, too, because even though it might be cheaper to make foods from scratch, people have to sort of balance out how much time they're taking. But it does sort of come up in the book that the less time it takes to cook food, the more likely we are to overeat it because there's plenty there and it didn't really cost us anything.
Well, that's right. And that's another paradox, that as we cook less, we're eating more. And what happens is when you outsource food to industry, to the fast food industry or processed food industry, they make a different kind of food than you would make at home. When you're cooking at home, you're making meals, basically, what the USDA calls primary eating. But now there's a new category called secondary eating that's actually bigger than primary eating. We're spending about 78 minutes a day in secondary eating. This is eating while you're doing other things, eating on the run, eating while you're, you know, surfing the internet or watching TV, eating in the car, where about 20% of the food is being eaten in America today, believe it or not.
Wow.
And you're not eating home-cooked food under those circumstances. And the kind of food that corporations make for you to eat at those times is snack food. It's some of the most fattening. most sugary foods you can get. And so corporations cook in different ways than we do. I mean, French fries are a great example. I mean, French fries were, if you cook at home, and in the past, French fries were a kind of occasional thing because they're a real pain to make. You know, you've got to wash the potatoes, cut the potatoes, fry the potatoes, then figure out what to do with the oil and clean up the stovetop, which is going to be, like, totally greasy. And so you would make it once a month, every 6 weeks or so. But corporations can cook something like a potato, a French fry, so efficiently that many of us can have it twice a day. Hmm. And so the time cost of cooking foods like that has fallen. And as that has happened, this is an economics term, the time cost, as that has happened, people are eating more. And most of the calories we've been eating, the increase in calories since the 80s, are in the forms of these high-calorie corporate cooked foods. So there's something built into the nature of home cooking that will nudge you in the direction of, you know, good quality ingredients simply prepared. You're just not going to make, you're not going to bake dessert every night, and you're not going to make French fries every day.
Yeah, so like eat whatever you want, but require yourself to make it from scratch and
exactly.
See what that turns out.
That's a really important and telling rule, and it came from someone I was interviewing who works in the food industry, and he's a market research guy in Chicago named Harry Balzer. And we were talking about, and he doesn't think that there is a future for home cooking. He thinks we'll look back on it and think, you know, the way, you know, 90% of people knew how to bake bread 100 years ago, now it's a very, you know, specialized, rare hobby. He thinks everyday home cooking will be the same way in the next few years. But I talked to him. I said, well, what about the obesity epidemic? And he acknowledged that that was the result of eating corporate cooked food. But then he said, you want to know a diet for America? Eat anything you want. Just cook it yourself. And that's a, you know, there's the voice from deep in the belly of the beast. And, you know, they're telling you what you need to know there.
So it's funny that so few Americans still know how to bake bread. And you cover this, you have the book divided up into four sort of elemental chapters, and the bread is in the air chapter. We take it for granted, but there's something really miraculous about the process of turning flour and water and salt into something we love so much as bread, and it's not that hard.
It's not that hard, and I was really intimidated by bread. I thought it was kind of the rocket science of cooking. I mean, that, you know, you really had to have an advanced degree. But of course, you know, people with very limited educations have cooked bread very well for thousands of years. And in fact, once you get comfortable doing it and do it a few times, you can throw out your recipe book and trust your senses. And it's an incredibly sensual process. I still, you know, I learned how to do it because I wanted to understand bread, not because I thought I'd become a baker, but I'm still baking. And I have my sourdough starter that is languishing in my fridge right now. I'm going to have to revive when I get home from book tour. But it's a remarkably satisfying process, and it's very easy to weave into a day of working at home. I mean, I'm a writer, so I work at home, but a lot of people work at home now. And all you have to do is every 45 minutes or so, give it a little turn, you know, smell the dough, feel it, just see if it feels, you know, like it's billowy and filling with air, and then you know it's time to bake. You know, it's, you know, I don't do it every day. It's not a staple of my life, but it's now something I do in my leisure. And we're in this funny place now that cooking is not obligatory, that there is someone who will bake your bread and cook your food, so you don't have to do it. So you have to find a reason to want to do it. Hmm. And that's really kind of where I came out the other end in this process of learning how to cook. That it gave me a lot of satisfactions that I didn't expect. It gave my family a lot of satisfactions. And so that, you know, the argument of this book is not you should or you must do this or you know, it's good for you, even though it is very good for you. It's that, you know, if you approach it in the right spirit, you can find enormous satisfaction and pleasure in the kitchen. And that so few of us do is the result of, I think, marketing and this cult of busyness that we feel. And yes, we are busy, and we do have a time crunch. But, you know, we've all found 2 hours in the last 10 years to spend online outside of work. Hmm. So we decided it was important, and we do it. And we think it's important to go to the gym, so we make that time, that hour to go to the gym. Well, my case is that this is just as important to your health, to the health of the well-being of your family, that it deserves that kind of time, and it rewards that kind of investment. In the same way, you know, going to the gym is going to improve your health, cooking is going to improve your health too.
Michael Pollan is with us. He is Knight Professor of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of the new book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. We will come back to our discussion with Michael in just a couple of minutes. Right now, we are pausing because we are doing the spring membership campaign, spring fundraising campaign. We know how many of you are rabid fans of Michael Pollan, with great reason. And we have copies of the new book, Cooked, available as a thank you gift today when you make a contribution at the level of $10 a month or above. So get in touch with us now at kera.org to set that up for yourself, or call 1-888-694-6931. Executive producer Jeff Whittington is with us now. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. A couple of other exciting things to let people know about. Well, first of all, this hour, our goal is 40 contributions in any amount. 33 contributions to go to make that goal. So call 888-694-6931 or click and join at kera.org. And yes, please do pick up a copy of Michael Pollan's new book, Cooked, with our thanks at the $120 membership level. When you call or when you join online, you're automatically going to be entered into tonight's drawing for a brand new LG 50-inch. That's 5-0, folks, not a 15-inch television.
I'm so glad that my husband is not qualified to win, even if he calls in and makes a contribution right now.
A 50-inch television. This is an HD LED TV. It's an Energy Star television. Plus, we're going to throw in Downton Abbey and Rick Steves, 100 episodes of Rick Steves, and Ken Burns Baseball. I mean,
this is a great prize.
This is going to be drawn for tonight. Someone's going to win. It could be you. Also, we've got a challenge going today. This morning, Ramirez and I were talking about being in ChalCon 1, Challenge Condition 1.
Yeah, I tuned in the middle of that, yeah. And I wasn't sure what that was.
And now I think we're probably moving into ChalCon 2 or 3 because the urgency is ramping up. It's a $10,000 challenge that KERA can unlock if we hear from 1,000 listeners today with a contribution. So you're one of those folks we need to hear from right now at 888-694-6993. 3-1, ChalCon 2.
I think it actually goes the other way, though. I think the lower the number, the greater the crisis.
Not according to the seminal film War Games.
All right. Well, I will stand corrected and defer to you on that. 888-694-6931 is our telephone number. You can also make your contribution online at kera.org. It didn't used to be that you could set up a sustaining membership online, but now you can. It's super easy, and you can do it with a debit or credit card. It doesn't just have to be a check. So it's very easy if you haven't done a membership in a while or you've never done a membership. We have made it just about as convenient as it can possibly be, short of like Jeff coming to your house and reaching into your back pocket and taking out some cash.
We're working on that, though. We are working to develop that technology. We're not quite there yet, but we're not anywhere near it yet. We don't even know your name necessarily unless you call and tell us. But I hope you'll call and tell us your name. We'd love to say your name and thank you on the air for your contribution. Call 888-694-6931. Tell us your name. Tell us your information. And tell us you want to support KERA. Or do it online at kera.org.
So many of you, I know, will be running out to buy the latest book by Michael Pollan anyway. Why not receive it as a thank you gift and also support KERA at the same time? You can do that by going online to kera.org, making a contribution at or above the level of what amounts to $120 a year, or call in to 1-888-694-6931.
The best part is you get to decide. Maybe you are desperate to have the book, so you go get it right now, but then you give your entire contribution
Absolutely.
Of $120 Perfect. To the station and choose to receive no thank you gift. That's what most people do. So do it now. Do it online at kera.org. And thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Michael Pollan. He is Knight Professor of Journalism at UC Berkeley and author of the brand new book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Small thing here, Michael, but it was such an interesting detail that I wanted to bring it up. I did not know until reading your book that sourdough bread in particular breaks down a lot of the gluten, which so many people are concerned about these days.
Yeah, one of the, there is this rise in gluten intolerance and celiac disease, which is kind of an extreme form of gluten intolerance. And people have been trying to figure out why this should be happening. And one theory that the Italian scientists are exploring is the idea that when we move to leavening bread with quick-acting yeast, and away from using a sourdough culture, the gluten isn't broken down in the same way. And if you have a bread that's well fermented with a sourdough culture over 12 hours or even overnight, that in those cases the peptides on the gluten that give people trouble are broken down. So it may be the way we're baking bread that's contributing to this problem, but it is still just a theory, and there's some other theories too.
We should say cooking in general, no matter how you do it, and we'll talk about other methods throughout the hour, but it really does allow us to get more nutrition faster from the foods we eat as opposed to our distant ancestors who had to sort of chew everything up raw.
Yeah, cooking is a really key invention, and in many ways helped make us human. Before people had control of fire, which happens, it may be as old as 2 million years, we ate raw food like the animals do. And if you watch animals, they spend a lot of time not just gathering food, but chewing it. And the apes, who ate this raw plant diet, they needed very large kind of intestines to process all that food. And they spent about 6 hours a day chewing food, which doesn't leave a lot of time to get anything else done. And so that when we started cooking, food becomes much easier to digest, much easier to chew, and your body doesn't have to use as much energy in the process of breaking it down. And that is what underwrote the expansion of the human brain. There's a moment that happens about 2 million years ago when the proto-human brain gets really large and our gut gets really small relative to other animals our size. And it is cooking that allowed that to happen. So that was the real takeoff point for humans, was cooking. And cooking gave us other things, too. It gave us the meal, because suddenly you've got a fire that you have to tend. It requires cooperation. The meat has to be shared. So you need rules, and you need you need to kind of regulate those social relationships, and there begins civilization.
And there's little doubt that when we did suddenly learn to control fire, probably the first thing we tossed onto it was meat.
Yeah, that was what we always wanted to toss onto it. meat was hard to find, but when you could find it, it was precious, and people were thrilled to have it. And you can cook it over a fire really well, as anyone who's enjoyed barbecue knows really well. It's much harder to cook grain, say. It's much harder to cook plants over fires. And that's why the next big technological advance in cooking is cooking in pots with water. And that's the second transformation that I deal with in the book. And 'cause as soon as you have ceramic pottery, which is 10,000 years ago, you can soften things in water, you can soften grain, you can make a porridge, and that's a big breakthrough because suddenly you have this soft food that old people can eat even after they've lost their teeth, and you can wean babies sooner. So the pot allowed us to extend the human lifespan quite a bit. It also allows you to combine flavors, and that's when you get culturally distinct foods. Because food cooked over fire, it's pretty generic. But as soon as you're combining these aromatic plants and whatever the local spices are, the local source of oil, you then have the rise of these food cultures, and that happens in the pot.
It's funny, too, because we don't, of all the ways to cook things, you know, making soups or braising things, it seems very unsexy in the present food climate.
Yeah, except these are some of the most beautiful, comforting foods we have. I mean, stews and soups and braises, and it is the basis of, it's peasant cooking. I mean, it doesn't have a lot of glamour, but this is how people who didn't have a lot of money cooked. Because if you're slow cooking in a pot, you can use the cheapest cuts of meat and, you know, the tough cuts that you could never grill. And if you give them enough time in a low temperature, they break down and they become incredibly tasty, much more flavorful than the you know, luxury cuts. So it's a very economical way of cooking, although it takes time.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time is not your time, as a chef told me. And, you know, you can start these things in a crock pot in the morning, you know, with 20 minutes of just kind of chopping an onion and browning your meat and put the liquid in, put it all together. And then you come home and you open the door and there is the smell of a home-cooked meal while you've been at work, and it's done and it's delicious.
And it's worth reminding folks that there are other media in which to cook foods besides chicken stock.
Yes. It's really overused. It's everybody's default. And one of the, you know, I worked with a wonderful chef in the pot cooking section, Chapanese trained and Iranian American, and she said, you know, water is really underappreciated as a cooking liquid. If you've got flavorful vegetables and you know, some kind of animal protein, say, you don't need to use chicken stock. Just slow cooking with those vegetables is going to give you a beautiful sauce. And there's, or you can just use a little wine, or you can even use vinegar. Vinegar gets very mellow after, you know, an hour of cooking, and makes a delicious liquid in which to cook. So we're kind of stuck in that rut of chicken stock, and everything ends up tasting like chicken.
You even tried something that you called like the most unkosher meal of all time, or I forget the exact phrase you used, that sort of surprised you.
Yeah, this is an old Roman dish. It's an ancient dish, which is pork braised in milk.
Hmm.
It's a really simple dish. I think it has like three ingredients or four ingredients, and you don't even need a base of onions. You brown your pork and use a pork, you know, chunk up a pork shoulder, and then you add the juice of a lemon, and a little bit of the rind of the lemon, and some milk. And you have to cook it very carefully at a very low temperature, because if the milk burns in your pot, you will never get that pot clean. I mean, I took hours when I burnt it. So you really want to keep it from boiling. And an amazing thing happens. The milk curdles, and it will look disgusting for the first few hours. It'll look like something your baby, you know, left on your shoulder. And that is exactly what your baby leaves on your shoulder. It's milk
curdled milk, sure.
In acid. But as it goes on, those curds turn golden and are incredibly flavorful, and the meat breaks down because of the enzymes in the milk, and it is the most delicious dish. But be careful about the temperature. Don't let it burn, or you're going to have a big headache.
Why is it that braising brings out that umami flavor so well?
Well, you know, that is, I think, the essence of braises and stews and soup. And I think what it is that slow cooking over time breaks down the proteins in the vegetables or the meat. And what umami is the taste of certain amino acids, glutamate, inosinate, and guanosinate, if I'm remembering correctly. But glutamate is the main one. And it is one of the building blocks of proteins. And you can't taste it until you've broken down the protein. And that slow cooking, that's exactly what it's doing. It's gradually breaking down the proteins and releasing the umami. But you can add to that impression, and umami is really the Japanese word for savoriness. It's that quality we get from a slow-cooked food. But you can get it in tomato paste, and that's the reason a lot of braises do include a tomato product of some kind, or Parmesan cheese. Mm-hmm. Or soy sauce. I mean, there are these, you know, shortcuts to getting umami. But if you slow cook meat or vegetables, you will get it. And that is what really gives that richness and that satisfyingness to a slow-cooked braise or stew.
When I hear the word glutamate, I think monosodium glutamate. But this is like the natural, not
this
scary
natural
version?
This is the natural form. Yeah. Although monosodium glutamate, I have to say, I mean, I looked into the science of that. There's really no evidence that it's a health problem. But this is the natural form of it. And glutamate is a very important nutrient. It nourishes the lining of the stomach and the intestines. And one of the reasons we like that taste, I was very curious to see, is that there's lots of glutamate in breast milk. We've had this taste before. In the same way we're first exposed to sweetness in breast milk, has got a lot of sugars in it, it has a lot of glutamate as well. So these are really primal. There's a reason that comfort foods always have sweetness and/or glutamate in them.
So your final section is called Earth, and it focuses on fermentation, which is a fascinating process, not only because, you know, it changes the food, but because every culture seems to have interpreted this in its own way.
Yeah, every culture has fermented food, and it makes sense because before we had refrigeration, that was basically the chief way to keep food from rotting and getting through the season when you didn't have fresh produce. Basically, what you're doing, it is a miraculous way of cooking, and some people don't even think of it as cooking, but of course it is. You're cooking without the use of heat. You're using microbes, bacteria, and fungi to transform the food in a way that adds to its nutritiousness, its flavor. It creates these very distinct, strong flavors, and it preserves it. And the reason it does that is that the bacteria that go to work, and this could I could be talking about milk here or vegetable ferments. Cheese, of course, is just fermented milk. They're lactobacilli, is the kind of bacteria that go to work on these things, and they digest the sugars in the food, and their byproduct is lactic acid. And as that food acidifies, it becomes safer because other bacteria can't survive in the acid conditions. So for, you know, hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of years, when people wanted to preserve food, they would dig a pit, put the vegetables in it or the meat, cover it, and it would acidify and then stabilize. And they found a pit of fermented taro in the South Sea Islands that was 300 years old.
Wow.
And still edible, though I don't know that I'd want to try it.
I wouldn't be the first to try it, that's for
no,
sure.
No, I wouldn't have gone first either.
Michael Pollan is with us. He's Knight Professor of Journalism at UC Berkeley, and he's got a new book out called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We'll speak more with Michael Pollan in just a few minutes, and you can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. In the meantime, if you would go online to kera.org by itself and send a contribution, a gift of financial support, we would greatly appreciate it. We're looking for 40 contributions in this hour of Think to stay on target. We have 20 left to go. It should be easy to get this done, especially because we have a guest of this caliber. We have a gift of Michael Pollan's new book, Cooked, and we know how much you love KERA. Jeff Whittington joins us now. Jeff, we've got the phone number.
We have all kinds
of
incentives.
We've got the website. We got everything.
We are incentivizing. We have a drawing tonight, mm-hmm, for a 50-inch HD LED LG TV. How about that? I rolled it right off. I wasn't even reading it. And we were you said you're so glad that your husband's not eligible because he's your husband.
Yeah, because we have a living room that's like only a little wider than 50 inches.
But if you have the wall space, and you know, this may be the perfect way for you to convince your significant other.
I want it.
That this is, I did it doing a good thing. Jeff Ramirez and I were joking about this morning. We figured that the Morning Edition crowd probably wasn't ready for that joke, but I think now at this point in the day, we can make that gag. This is a great way to get a 50-inch TV in your house.
A TV,
listener.
In many cases, probably larger than some of your kids.
That's right. So this is, it's big. It's wider than 4 feet right?
Yeah.
So this is a big television. And so a lot of people have really been interested in this. We're going to draw that winner tonight. Everybody who's made a contribution during the drive is entered. So you're already in there if you've given. But if you haven't given, you're not in there. So you got to call right now, 888-694-6931, online at kera.org. What a great guest this hour. Michael Pollan is always so good. If you're a fan of Michael Pollan's, from The Botany of Desire to The Omnivore's Dilemma to now his book Cooked, I mean, all the work that he's done on food, and his reporting style is so great. I mean, I'm really looking forward to the next segment. We're taking this break right now so that you will call. You will take a couple of minutes, make your contribution, and then come back and listen to the last part of the interview. It's coming up in just a couple of minutes.
KERA.org is the website. You can also call 1-888-694-6931. The great thing about making a contribution to KERA is that not only are you doing something for your community, this is kind of a no-risk contribution, right? Because every single moment of every day, you can tune into your radio or find our live stream online and know exactly what your money is paying for. Know the kind of quality programming, the kind of expanded local journalism presence that we are providing here because you said you wanted it. Sometimes we put the cart before the horse here. You all, as an audience, say, we'd love to have more local coverage. And we said, great. And then we've just sort of taken it on faith that those of you enjoying this local coverage will also help to support it financially.
Yeah, we've always done that with public radio. We've always, you know, gone out and collected incredible sound, incredible stories, told them in a long format that no commercial station would ever support or approve, and then given it away to you and everyone else that has access to a radio or to now an internet stream or a smartphone app for free. And then we come back and say, hey, remember that show you enjoyed, that report you liked? Remember when you were couldn't get out of your car? Well, now it's time to help defray the cost of what it costs, what we've already spent months ago, probably, to prepare that for you, to report that, to broadcast it. And that's what we're doing today. Put a price on it. Most listeners decide it's worth about $10 a month. Most of your, you know, comrades in public radio listening here in North Texas and around the country think KERA is worth about $10 a month. Miraculously, that's the level at which we would like to thank you with a copy of Michael Pollan's new book.
That's right. But if you are in a place, if you love public radio enough and your budget allows for it, of course, you can make a larger contribution, even a friends level contribution of $125 a month. And you get all kinds of other special benefits that you can learn about online.
You could probably throw in the book as well.
And we'll throw in the book as well. Absolutely.
Say
Chris and Jeff said you could also have a book if you become a friends level member. And the reality is, if your budget doesn't allow for $10 a month, you can do $5 a month. Or you can do a one time gift. Just please make a contribution now at kera.org or call 1-888-694-6931. Back in just a minute with Michael Pollan.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Knight Professor of Journalism at UC Berkeley, Michael Pollan. His newest book is called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. And Michael, of course, when we talk about transformation through fermentation, we almost cannot leave out things like beer and wine.
No, I know. Those are some of the most miraculous things that microbes give us. I really believe that man's best friend is not the dog, but Saccharomyces cerevisiae. That is the yeast that gives us not only bread, but wine and beer and all forms of alcoholic beverage. It's an incredible creature, and it basically takes the sugars in this thing and turns them into alcohol. And that has given a great blessing to humankind for tens of thousands of years.
How hard is it to harness those things to make them do what we actually want them to do in terms of flavor and viscosity, that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, you know, it's not that hard to make alcohol. It's hard to make really good alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
The easiest thing to make, and in fact the oldest kind of alcoholic beverage, is mead, which is a wine made from honey. And all you really need to do that is to dilute honey. Undiluted honey is very hard. It's incredibly stable, as we all know. It lasts forever. And it has these antimicrobial compounds in it, and it's so rich in sugar that things can't grow in it. But if you dilute it about 3 or 4 to 1 with water, it will spontaneously begin to ferment. There are yeasts already in it that the bees have, brought into their hives. Or you can add champagne yeast, which is a very tough yeast that you can buy at a brew supply store. And within a week, you're going to have an alcoholic beverage. It's good. It's not great. but you can, then you can add some spice to it and do interesting things to it. And then if you age it, it actually gets quite good. There's some harsh compounds in honey that you want to mellow out. And beer is, another order of magnitude of complexity, because to make grain sweet enough to ferment, you have to malt it, which is basically you're cooking the barley. That's what you use. And you don't cook it. You buy it cooked. And that process of cooking is it's germinated first and then cooked. And the germination starts turning the starch into sugars, and then the cooking halts it and creates a whole interesting range of toasty flavors. And then I'm not going to give you the whole recipe now, but then you basically mush that in water, and it becomes quite sweet, and introduce your yeast, and you're off to the races. It's a lot of fun brewing beer, and I found it was a really nice way to connect with my teenage son. It was something we really enjoyed doing together before he went off to college. And that there is a real revival of home brewing going on. And one of the reasons we have this incredible renaissance of craft beers in this country, there are now thousands of... We were down to 50 breweries in America in the 60s, I guess it was. And beer in America was, Budweiser, basically, and things like it. And now we've got thousands of new breweries. And most of them started out as home brewers who got really good at it and got passionate about it.
I'm glad you brought up the bonding with your son, because so many of the explorations in this book, you want to understand something, so you go to someone and you spend time together. It seems like cooking used to be very naturally a communal activity in a lot of communities, and now it's something that people often do, unfortunately, in isolation.
I think you're right, and I think that's one of the reasons that it became a burden. In the nuclear family, it fell to usually to the woman of the household cooking alone while everybody else was out during the day. And cooking alone can be a drag. But you look historically, and cooking was a communal thing. It was multi-generational. There were a lot of people in the kitchen. And there is no better setting in which to have a conversation with your kid or with your husband or wife or friends than in the kitchen. The rhythms of it are just so conducive to talk. And I think that was a mistake we made, to isolate cooking. And if we are going to rebuild a culture of home cooking, it's obviously not going to be the one we had. The one we had was unfair. The one we had was drudgery very often. And so I think it's really important that we get, both members of the marriage back into the kitchen and the kids, and amazing things happen. And in my house now, my son will do his homework. If he's too busy to help us, we still make him chop an onion or mince some garlic before he starts, and then he sits down and does his homework in the kitchen at the island. And we talk while we're cooking, and he comes over and offers unsolicited seasoning advice. And he's got very good taste buds. And then, of course, home cooking implies the meal, The meal is such a precious institution. I really believe it's the nursery of democracy. Weird as that sounds, but it's at the table where we teach our kids how to take turns and share and argue without offending, and they learn the art of adult conversation. So much is learned at the table that can't be learned any other way.
Yeah, it's funny. There are so many studies about the value of just sitting down together as a family for a meal. And it seems like one of the first things that families sacrifice when they get busy.
Yeah, it's an easy thing to let go, and it's a big mistake. Families who have family meal more often than not, the kids do better in school, less problems with drugs and alcohol. It just is a very important socializing force that's available to all of us. And you know, we feel pressed, but again, it's one of those things that is so important that it's worth making time for.
We have an email here from Jennifer in Parker County who says, I can't eat prepackaged foods if I want to feel good. It does take more time and effort to cook real food at home, but in exchange, there are so many pleasures. Shopping for fresh produce at the farmer's market, buying grass-fed meat locally, grinding my own spices. Every time I spread out these beautiful ingredients and prepare to cook them, I feel so wealthy and blessed. I wish everyone could take the time to experience this on a regular basis.
Oh, what a beautiful email.
Yeah.
I agree with her. It's really the perspective you bring to it, and it can the satisfactions are great, and but we're kind of in this trap, and part of it is the marketing. You know, the marketing is all convincing us we can't do it as well, we don't have time to do it. You know, the ads always show families in this state of high panic about getting out the door in the morning. We have to re-examine that and figure out, well, how are we using our time, and might there be a way to do this? We're also tired, when we get home from work, and that's an argument for, I try to cook a couple things on a Sunday. Sunday morning I'll often, make a big batch of tomato sauce or pasta sauce or a soup. And so that I know if I have a really busy day, there's something good in the fridge. Already, that's something I've cooked already. And that's the kind of, prepackaged food that I'm really happy to have around. But we need to keep in mind that corporations don't cook well, and they have not figured out how to cook healthy food. And until they figure that out, and I don't know that they will, because their business model is so much based on cheap, raw ingredients, lots of salt, fat, and sugar. They're in the business of manipulating our cravings, not in satisfying us, but making us eat more. And that's not the same thing. And, the most important thing about your diet is who's cooking it. Is it a human being or is it a corporation? If you cook yourself, you can just forget about worrying about nutrients, about calories. All that will simply fall into place because you're not, unless you're Paula Deen, you're not going to cook the kinds of stuff that industry is tempting us with every day.
Even Paula Deen, I guess, has had a bit of a change of heart.
I gather she's had a conversion experience, yeah, and a good thing, too, since she's struggling with type 2 diabetes.
Michael Pollan is Knight Professor of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of the new book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Michael, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. I really appreciate you making time for us.
Oh, very happy to be here, Chris. Thanks a lot.
Thanks to all of you listening today. Thanks to all of you calling and writing into the show. Thanks especially to those of you who have made contributions. We have just 10 contributions to go in order to make this goal for the first hour of Think Today. 40 donations is what we've been looking for. We have just 10 left in order to stay on track. We would love for you to be one of them and to then thank you with a copy of Michael Pollan's new book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Really interesting stuff. We just barely scratched the surface in this hour we've had him on. A terrific read if you are interested in food, in history, in science. Give us a call now at KERA.org and not only receive a copy of the book potentially, but support this kind of radio that has in-depth conversations with people as influential in our society today as someone like Michael Pollan. Jeff Whittington is here now. He is the executive producer who brings the whole show together. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. What a great conversation with Michael Pollan. I hope that people will call 888-694-6931. Take advantage of this offer we're making. You've got this copy of Michael Pollan's book, Cooked, his brand new book. It's just out. He's actually on tour right now. We called him at Minnesota Public Radio today for the interview where he braved a snowstorm to get there for his interview there. And we're able to offer this to you at the $120 membership level today when you call 888-694-6931. We're also going to automatically enter you into a drawing to win a brand new HD LED LG TV. It's a 50-inch Energy Star television. This is a really great opportunity for somebody to win a really nice piece of home theater equipment from KERA. And the idea is to get you encouraged to make the call today. We'd like to wrap up this drive successfully as soon as possible. And so we're hoping that if you haven't joined yet, you'd like to get in on this drawing, which is happening tonight. You could be the winner of this 50-inch HD LED television, courtesy of KERA.
You are a fan of public radio. You listen to public radio. You might even share stories on a regular basis with your friends and your family and your coworkers that you've discovered here on KERA, whether through our website or simply by word of mouth. That makes you a public radio person. But to be a public radio member is really special. It means that you decide that's worth paying for. You know, I would argue that if suddenly public radio were withdrawn and you had to pay for it like you pay for HBO or Hulu or, you know, magazine subscriptions, you would do so in a heartbeat. Unfortunately, it gets a little easy to take it for granted because of the model that we have going. But so many of you choose not to take it for granted, to in fact take a proactive step to keep public radio strong, to say, yes, we want to honor and support quality journalism, non-tabloid type reporting. We want to honor and support the idea of civil discourse. You can do this by going online now to make a contribution at kera.org or calling 1-888-694-6931.
Plus, if you've made it to take away from the elevation that Chris just gave us, if you made it through the 90s and the aughts without a tattoo, we can offer you public radio temporary tattoos today with your $120 contribution. There are 8 temporary tattoos. David Green from Morning Edition talked about sporting the Morning Edition tattoo, which you might think is sort of it might look like an open book with, or like a radio that looks very, you know, kind of
something erudite.
Right, right. No, it's a dagger with a snake wrapped around it, and it says Morning Edition. It's really tough looking. He put a picture of himself up on the NPR Morning Edition Facebook page. Well, you can get that very tattoo for your very own. You can check it out on the web at kera.org. We'll throw in 7 other tattoos.
If you want to make yours permanent, if you want to take it down to a tattoo studio, you'll have a guide right there.
That's right. Yeah,
just trace over these lines.
And when your mom sees it, just tell her that Chris Boyd said for you to do it.
I this is a true story. I worked at a radio station years ago that was a very different kind of radio station, and someone did get a tattoo of our logo, but she did it to win like Rod Stewart tickets.
Right.
Or something.
Right.
We're doing it in the spirit of.
Yeah, it's a temporary thing. It's fun. This is all
right.
In fun. Just like, you know, you have a good time listening to KERA. Call now 888-694-6931. 1-888-694-6931. Working on a goal this hour of 40 contributions. Last I checked, we were still needing about 10 contributions, Chris, to make our goal and stay on track to wrap up the drive as soon as possible. Don't forget Michael Pollan's new book, Cooked: A Natural History of Transformation, available to you when you make a contribution of $10 a month to KERA.
Look, in the same way that good food is worth paying a little extra for, that we don't want to just take what's the very cheapest and satisfy ourselves, even though we can fill our bellies, it's the same thing with information, right? Really good information, quality sources of news, that's worth paying for. And unlike any store or restaurant you can walk into, at KERA, the amount you pay is up to you. So you can go online to kera.org, choose a $10 or $20 or $5 or $100 a month membership, whatever you want to do, or make a one-time gift. You can also do this at 1-888-694-6931. If you want a thank you gift, lots of you don't take them, but if that would make the difference for you, there's lots of different things to choose, including Michael Pollan's book, Cooked, including all the other things we've talked about for the most part throughout this entire fundraising campaign.
888-694-6931 is the telephone number, online at kera.org. Don't forget, no contribution necessary to be entered, but you, if you make a contribution, you're automatically entered in the drawing for this 50-inch HD LED television. It's an LG brand. It's an Energy Star model. We're going to give that away tonight. You could win this, and we're going to throw in 100 Rick Steves Travels in Europe episodes on DVD. We're going to throw in Ken Burns' baseball series, the updated version. And we're going to throw in all 3 seasons of Downton Abbey.
You won't have to leave the house till like July.
That's right. And your neighbors, you know, across the lake will be able to watch TV with you without even leaving their home.
They can just put away those binoculars that are so cumbersome.
I want to thank Heather Scold and McKinney, Simon and Susan Cooper in Plano, and Brendan and Mia Morris in Carrollton. Also, Carol Swanison and Brian. Thank you, Carol. Probably listening on the web there. Appreciate that. Also, Ethan Kilgore in Dallas and Maureen Brenner in Dallas. These folks are paying for your public radio station, people. And, you know, I hope that you'll join them right now with a phone call to 888-694-6931.
Just seven to go in order to make our goal for the hour. We can do this in the next couple of minutes. Now we've got five to go. This is definitely possible if you will take action right now for your public radio station, KERA. You can do this online at kera.org, or you can call in to 1-888-694-6931. If you're interested in reading Michael Pollan's book and supporting the station at the $10 a month level or above, then ask for Cooked as your thank you gift today. Thanks again. The website is kera.org. The number 1-888-694-6931.